One of the things that drew me to El Salvador was an interest in pursuing liberation theology. I had done a little reading, not much, on liberation theology, and I was intrigued by what I'd read. And I was debating whether I should study further or pursue more formal studies in that area. But having visited El Salvador a couple of times, I sensed that this was a place where liberation theology was being lived. And that had appeal for me. I felt what I knew about liberation theology was that it was something that was kind of grew from the grassroots. And it wasn't something that academic theologians put together in libraries or in their offices. But it was something that started from the bottom, and then later theologians or writers would reflect on it and publish what was happening among the people. So I felt that to learn about it, it would be preferable to learn from the people themselves, the people from whom it was surging, growing. And not to say that reading about it, studying about it in more formal settings is not worthwhile. I would like to do more of that myself. But I was glad, have been glad for the opportunity of living in a place and among people who live that kind of theology. In the Lutheran Church in El Salvador, liberation theology isn't talked about with that terminology. In fact, Bishop Mirardo Gomez is actually rather careful about using that term. He's traveled extensively in the U.S. and in Europe, and been to Canada once or twice. And he recognizes that it raises red flags for a lot of people. A lot of people have heard the condemnations about it being influenced heavily by Marxist ideology and so on. And he's aware that some people just turn off when they hear the phrase or the term liberation theology.
What exactly is it?
It's, okay, well, I'll
get into it
little by little. He's, in reflecting on it himself, he says that any theology that is not liberating, any time you talk about God, and you're talking about a God that's not liberating, then you're not really talking about God. God is a God of liberation, and to talk about God in any other way is to talk about somebody or something other than God. But recognizing people's apprehensions or nervousness about the term liberation theology, he has developed other language and other ways of talking about it, other ways of addressing it, and he talks about the theology of life, which I think is very similar to liberation theology. It's not identical. It's kind of his and the Lutheran Church's their own understanding or version of how the Church responds to the crisis in which they live. For Bishop Gomez and the Lutheran Church, theology of life is responding to whatever forces of death they encounter in that society, and there are many. The poverty, which is so closely linked to exploitation and repression, and the disease and the starvation that accompanies the desperate poverty, the death that comes through the Civil War, 75,000 people having been killed through the Civil War, and the death squad activities, the assassinations, the massacres, the disappearances, thousands of deaths due to earthquake, the earthquake of 86, fall of 86, which has left many people, well, thousands dead and many thousands more homeless in slums and squatter settlements in the capital of San Salvador. So the Church has responded to all of these death forces with this theology of life, which in practice is just, in many ways, what the Church has done in every society, in every country, in every situation. for years, for centuries. Proclaiming the gospel, for one thing, the gospel of Jesus' love. Jesus loves these people. And that in very practical ways, by accompanying the proclamation and the worship with very down-to-earth programs of medicine and education, housing developments, water projects, agricultural projects, community development, community building as a project. And as I said, those are all fairly traditional work for the church, for mission work, for whatever. Whoever calls himself Christian and is responding to the mandate of the gospel. In El Salvador, it takes on a little different flavor because any of that work is quite quickly viewed as subversive by those who control, and which really are the forces of death. In this book, actually, Minardo goes into quite, well, fuego contra fuego, the fire that impassions the people in the response, in the Christian response, is pitted against the fire of what he calls the powers, the principalities, much the way Paul talks about the gospel confronting the evil in his New Testament letters. So the fire of faith and commitment is pitted against the fires of these forces of death in the country, which are, forces of greed, forces that want to control the land, the production, the export production, the politics, the army, the military. And so anybody seen to be working to change the system that benefits those forces is understood to be a threat, understood to be subversive, and then labeled as such as subversive or communist or FMLN or rebel or whatever, or collaborator with those forces. And so that, well, both alien, well, pits the, assigns those people to the role of enemy, and also dehumanizes them so that it becomes justifiable to do whatever to those people. Actually, the armed forces, I don't know if they even consider the enemy to be human anymore. When you see the atrocities committed against human beings, you really wonder if people can actually do that to other human beings. So it must be something that changes in the mentality that considers themselves to be fighting communism or whatever, but something that is no longer human. So the response of the church is very sacrificial. It's a very vulnerable kind of response in bringing life to people through these programs of housing or community development or education or medicine. Just to give you some examples, I'll show a few slides of some of the communities that the church is working in. And let those say a little about the story. And as we're doing that, I'll pass around this piece of artwork. This was a Christmas card that was sent to me last Christmas, shortly after I'd left El Salvador, by a friend who works with the church there. It's not exactly Hallmark theology, and it's rather stark, and I'm not sure that a lot of people could appreciate this kind of artwork. I showed this to a few friends around Canada, and we started thinking about the possibility of the idea that this piece of artwork could be enlarged and produced into a banner or mural. And so we worked on that and actually then invited this person, this artist, to Canada. And he's, over the last two or three weeks, together we put this into a mural, which was kind of a theme piece for the National Youth Gathering in Vancouver just last week. And it was interesting hearing some of the comments, both from adults and youth, about this piece that was don't know, 30 by 30 feet by 10 feet. For everyone it was disturbing, for some in a way that they felt was worthwhile and valuable for them and in as they reflected on it. For others it was disturbing to the point that the work had no value whatsoever. It was trash and shouldn't be there. And so I'll pass this around, and it's to me it reflects passion for life in the midst of death. And you'll notice you know, elements in it that are particularly Latin American flavor as well. So if we can pull the screen down and perhaps pull the drapes.
I might be able to reach
Church. Medardo Gomez is a prime example of this, feels it very necessary to be among the people, to listen to the people, hear their stories, hear the kinds of pain that they're experiencing, hear the death that they have and are experiencing, and then work with the people in developing a response to that pain, to that death. This is Resurrection Lutheran Church, which is both an appropriate and a paradoxical name for a church in that setting. It is the main, well, the center for the Lutheran Church in El Salvador. It's Bishop Gomez's church in San Salvador. It's here where a lot of the life of the church is centered. There are about 30 Lutheran parishes throughout the country, and each of those parishes has a number of other projects which they work with in communities surrounding their towns. But this is the worship center.
Is this still, it was bombed, or it was, well, it was bombed 2 years ago, right? But it was...
It was bombed in late December of 88.
And just searched and occupied at the time you worked
around? Right. I was in this church, actually, just in the office, just to the left behind when we were arrested. And I was, there was a German woman, myself, and a few Salvadorans. I was taking phone calls from North America, and she was taking calls from Germany. During the offensive, when the church was not this space exactly, but the schools and the clinic and other spaces of the church were being used to shelter displaced people, people displaced by the bombing in some of the peripheral neighborhoods of San Salvador. And also here we were interviewing representatives of the communities that were fleeing to the church for protection to find out exactly what they'd experienced and what was happening in their communities. So the National Guard entered the church and arrested us right in this space. They also took out a cross, which was off to the right, a white cross, big white cross, which named the sins of society, and they called the cross a prostitute and dragged it out. And, a Norwegian friend wrote me afterwards and he said he thought it curious that the army should have to arrest the cross. So this is the church from the other direction. Not a very imposing building, but it's a very memorable space for all that happens here. This is the neighborhood surrounding the church.
That's where they live, then?
Pardon?
They live in those little shacks?
Yes. And actually, currently, most of the street, this is, picture is a couple years old, most of the street now is covered by shacks. There's only one lane for traffic where you see those vehicles parked on the right-hand side. And it's interesting, the contrast in priorities. The church in the background is the Silesian Roman Catholic Church. And throughout this last year, they have been pouring, I don't know how many dollars, it must be in the millions, in reconstruction and renovation and redecorating. And the Archbishop of El Salvador and also the Archbishop Cardinal of Nicaragua are both members of the Silesian Order. But in contrast to that, the Lutheran Church, along with others like the Baptist, the Episcopal Church, many Roman Catholic parishes, have made it their priority to pour all of their resources, both human and financial resources, into communities, into building communities rather than buildings. And so there are shanty towns, communities of shacks throughout San Salvador, probably 250,000 people. About a third of the population of San Salvador live in shacks in the ravines around the steep hillsides. Many of those are victims of the earthquake. They still have not, or they've not received any benefit from international aid sent post-earthquake. And actually the earthquake of 86 enabled the church, or prompted the church perhaps, to become more involved with the urban poor. Prior to that, many of these urban poor lived in big old apartment blocks, and they were quite isolated from one another and from the church. But since 86, the church has become very, very involved with these communities. And there are several hundred communities and networks of support among the various communities, and a few thousand people living in each one. So the church sees these communities as a place where life and resurrection can happen. It's rather depressing to step into one of these communities. The first impression is you see the spaces where they live or exist, and it's hard to imagine people living in conditions like that. But then when you meet the people, you realize they're people of dignity, they're people of hope, especially now when they're working together with community councils. And many communities come together to, sometimes when negotiations have failed in terms of gaining land or gaining access to water, they'll come together and just go ahead and put in, or take over the land or put in their own water systems. Tens of thousands of people will come together to make sure that that can happen without military interference. And they're very gracious, generous people. They don't have much, but they assure you when you visit that whatever they have is yours to share with them. There are other organizations that work independently of the church, but alongside the church in close cooperation with these earthquake victims. And Tita, in this picture, was one of the workers very involved with UNADES, one organization that works with earthquake victims. Here she is with the two youngest ones are her children, and the guy in the yellow is her cousin. So I lived with this family for the first couple of months while I was in El Salvador. She is a very dynamic person. She's tireless, and she has a real way of sparking the energy in other people to motivate them to get involved. And also she was a strong voice for the plight of the earthquake victims, and often spoke to journalists and appeared on TV and in the papers. And evidently she was too dynamic, too successful in what she was doing, and she was targeted and disappeared on June 3rd of 89.
disappeared.
And nobody has seen or heard from her since that date, just over a year ago.
And left the little kid.
Yeah. And so they're left with her mother, and for some time after their mother's disappearance, they kept thinking they saw her on TV still. It was evidently not her. And I was involved, I went to the house as soon as I found out, and the mother came looking for me at the church. So we made the rounds of human rights lawyers and so on, trying to find out what we could do to locate her. And she was very stoic at first, and I was surprised by that, I was amazed by that. But then maybe a week or so later, she started to show the strain and the pain of it. It's not an uncommon occurrence, but when you're that close to it, it's really hard to imagine. And in a case like this, one never knows when to stop searching and to start grieving. So it's an ongoing pain. In the midst of that kind of pain, the church comes together and celebrates. And here is a parade going to Fe y Esperanza from San Salvador, well, part of the way. Bishop Gomez, I'm not sure, I think this is the anniversary of his ordination or commissioning as bishop of San Salvador. And so there'd be very festive parades and festive day of worship and cultural celebrations and feasting. I recognize Phil Anderson, he's been here at Holden recently. In the wait. So education is a priority of the church. This is the main school, the Colegio in San Salvador, offering grades 1 through 10. This was one of the buildings which was just crammed with displaced people during the offensive. People who came so traumatized they wouldn't stay in rooms facing the street. They were too afraid of military coming in and either ransacking the place or dragging people out, interrogating them, and so on. So they all huddled in back rooms in the dark and tried to organize and feed themselves like that. But education in San Salvador is not accessible to many people. It's in the rural areas especially, it's very difficult to find or to get to a school. And even in the urban areas where people are near a school, the tuition fees are prohibitive. And so the poorest of the people don't get an education if it weren't for the churches providing that. But even that education, whether it's church schools or whether it's schools set up by the communities and so on and bringing in teachers graduating from the universities, it seemed to be subversive. Because anyone understanding the reality of El Salvador and its history is inclined to want to change things, and that's a threat to the government. The church is involved in visiting a variety of communities. This is a group of some of the church workers visiting El Lago. The people from Fe y Esperanza moved, or had to move several times. They were displaced at Fe y Esperanza. From there they had to move to Panchmilama. When they were harassed so terribly there and bombed, many injured, some killed, they moved to this place, which was more isolated still, accessible only by a 45-minute boat ride. But the church visits regularly, and especially on days of celebration and festival. So this was a group of people leading the worship, the music for the worship. You can't see him very well, the artist and the guy who was supposed to be here, I mean the guy who painted this card was supposed to be here at Holden this week but wasn't given a visa by U.S. Immigration. He's on the far right, our right, in the white short sleeve shirt, El Mori Amaya. Well, that's the worship space. right at the bottom, just almost off the picture, is the altar. And the piñatas and streamers are ready for the afternoon's festivities. But under this huge amate tree happens the worship, the dancing, the feasting, and that's where many of us slept as well. It's an all-purpose tree. And passion for life centers on the Eucharist, receiving the body and blood of Christ. And so this is understood by Salvadorans not just as a private act of confession or forgiveness, but as something which rejuvenates the life in them as a community, and which motivates them for service and for commitment. So they, by receiving the body and blood of Christ, become the body of Christ in very sacrificial ways. The church has been very involved with the repatriation of refugees from Honduran refugee camps like Mesa Grande, and that began about 86, 87, and it was just completed now in this year of in February of 90. And it's really quite a phenomenon. These camps became so well organized in Honduras, and finally became so fed up with the Honduran, or the pressure and the repression from the Honduran government and its army, that they decided that no matter what the risks, they would want to return to El Salvador and as closely as possible to the original villages, their home villages. And so they're organized in groups of thousands and demanded of the Salvadoran government that they be able to come back. The Salvadoran government wanted, if they were to come back, wanted to do it in small groups or families in small groups and then move them into government-controlled villages. But the people insisted that they would move back to their own places. And they requested the support, the assistance of the Red Cross, or the United Nations, pardon me, and also the churches. So the Lutheran Church has been one of those active in accompanying this repatriation, which has happened in several stages. This particular community is Santa Marta, Colomancagua, Mesa Grande, San Antonio, others, camps in Honduras have now virtually been vacated. A number of those refugees have also been accepted in Canada. Along with the days of celebration, the church also accompanies the people on their days of pain and commemoration of, in this case, the massacre, which happened as they crossed or fled from El Salvador into Honduras over the River Lempa on the 18th of March, 1981, and several hundred people were slaughtered as they crossed, as they were sandwiched between the Salvadoran and the Honduran armies, and mostly women and children were slaughtered in that crossing. So this was the massacre that they're commemorating. So the Lutheran Church accompanies these people with as many visitors as possible for such events. It's not easy to get to these places. You require military permission to get to these places, and you have to apply for that 2 weeks in advance. Now they've just made it even more difficult. It requires a series of three interviews, two before you go and one after you come back, to be able to get to these places. And it's, even if you get the permission, there's still no guarantee that, and sometimes that works. That's a little harder for Canadians or US citizens. But it's all part of the strategy of the government to isolate these places and to keep and that's true of medical supplies, construction materials, educational materials, you know, whatever is being sent to these places. And the harassment of the military is ongoing, and many of these communities have been attacked and continue to be attacked, and people are killed. The people say, though, that they will not flee again. They would rather die in these places than flee back to Honduras. There's a question about the bombing of the Lutheran Church, and this is what happens to a church that makes such a commitment on behalf of the poor and the marginalized, the victims of such repressive society. These are the offices. What looks like the Obama garage door was the entrance to the main secretarial office, and the window just to the right in the middle of the picture was the bishop's office. This happened on December 28th of 1988, and during that week the church was every day visiting these communities of earthquake victims, the orphanage one day, repatriation communities, and so hundreds of people were leaving every day to make these visits. And so the middle of the week, Wednesday, we arrived at the church early to discover this destruction. It seemed, significant and tragic in a way that this was the day, the Holy Innocents Day, which the global church recognizes or commemorates the slaughter by King Herod of baby boys 2 years and younger. A king so powerful and yet so threatened by babies that he had to kill them. And here too it seems that the powerful feel so threatened by a tiny church working with the poor that it has to be wiped out, or at least intimidated to the point of hopefully ceasing its work. So we gathered about six and were stood in stunned silence for a while, wondering how something like this could happen. So the door in the center leads to the bishop's office. This is from the other direction now. And on the right, to the right of that, is the main secretarial office. This was all reconstructed and was just put into use in about September of last year. About a week later, another bomb was placed just a few meters down the street and didn't destroy the newly reconstructed property, but the church had just purchased the neighboring property also. And so that property was bombed. And Bishop Gomez, just after the bombing. So after a couple hours of initial cleanup, we gathered for prayer, for some decision making on how we should proceed. It was a matter of deciding whether we should proceed with the visits as planned, or whether we should maybe take the attack as seriously as intimidation and maybe lie low for a while. After praying through it, everyone decided unanimously that we should go ahead with the visits. Some would stay behind and to meet with media and diplomats and so on from various countries. But the rest of us went out on the visits planned for that day. Then when we came back, there were hundreds gathered for a prayer vigil, which lasted about 3 hours. And there were words of greeting and support from many different churches and communities and organizations. And once the main prayer vigil was over, another 50 of us stayed throughout the night and continued the vigil before going out in the next day's visits. Some of these I had showed the other day, so I won't go further with these at this point. But just to give you some idea of how the theology of life is lived out in very practical ways, in the midst of, in the face of death, of very blatant forces of death. And then what the consequences of that are for the church and its members. So the consequences in terms of the attack on the church. For the members, it means frequently arrest, detention, disappearance, torture, very intense interrogation, being forced into exile, not being granted visas to the U.S., On the same day that Balmori applied in El Salvador for a visa and was rejected, Bishop Gomez was also denied a visa to come to the U.S.
funding that? Is that the US government or the...
Right, the US Embassy in El Salvador. We tried again in Vancouver in Dalmori's case because we were there and the US consulate denied the visa there too.
What was the reason given or did they give it?
Well, they said in El Salvador they wanted proof that he had a big bank account or a lot of property to prove that he would actually return to El Salvador. And in Vancouver then they said, well, for the same reason that they didn't think he would ever leave the US if he ever entered. But also that he should have applied in El Salvador. He wasn't secured in a third country, pardon?
Was he an El Salvador citizen?
Yes. No. So the explanation there was that he shouldn't apply out of his own country. While the consulate was full, hundreds of people applying outside of their own country. Yeah. Canadians don't need visas, so this office was full of people applying for U.S. visas. But
how were the Canadian authorities... what was their response when he applied for a visa?
He applied to Canada for us. He was going to be in Canada for 6 weeks, and they gave him a year visa with no question.
This was through the Canadian consulate.
Yeah.
So is he in Canada right now?
Yeah.
The bishop?
No, this is Balmoral.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Maya, the artist. He's been at the National Worship Conference and the National Youth Gathering.
How many Lutherans are there in El Salvador?
There are, well, they're not very careful about keeping statistics. I would estimate maybe 7,000 or 8,000 actually on the membership lists. But if you're going to go around the country and ask, you know, people like in these communities whether they were Lutherans, they would probably say yes. I mean, a lot of them consider Minardo Gomez to be their bishop, even though they're not officially Lutherans, they're Roman Catholics, basically. But there might be, I don't know how many, hundreds of thousands perhaps that would consider him to be their bishop. And not necessarily rejecting their membership with the Roman Catholic Church, but for them it's one and the same. And if I go into these communities, I can celebrate the Mass with the Roman Catholic priest and there's no problem for the people or for even the Roman Catholic Church. So it's hard to really say how many Lutherans there are. A lot of them just consider themselves to be Lutherans because they've been assisted by the Lutheran Church.
Now, how was the church established? By Scandinavian Lutherans or Canadian, American? Do you know how long it's been there?
Actually, the first Lutheran presence was in 1952. And the first Salvadoran Lutheran pastor was in 1962. It was from the U.S. and mostly from what Missouri Synod at that time, although those relations have been broken because of differences in policy around ordination of women and ecumenical relationships and so on, membership in Lutheran World Federation. But Missouri Synod was the parent church for the church, Lutheran Church in El Salvador. Minardo Gomez began the church in San Salvador in 1972 and began as pastor there. In 1982, when Fe y Esperanza was opened as a response to the displaced people, displaced by the bombings of the Air Force and the raids of the army, that's really when the social work of the church began to mushroom. And Socorro Luterano, Lutheran Aid, at that point had just, I don't know, two or three employees, and by 85 or 86 there were upwards of 100. Like, it's just grown dramatically. And so now there are perhaps 100 different Lutheran communities and projects throughout the country. And each Lutheran parish, if like when they're sort of gathering to support one another and hear what each other's doing, if each parish hasn't started at least two or three projects each year, they consider that they're not being very faithful to the gospel. So it's pretty amazing. And most of the pastors, well, they're Salvadoran, but most of them are have very little formal education, but they're highly respected within their communities as spiritual leaders, motivators.
A couple questions. After the generation of people have grown up with this war, and so many thousands of people have died, what do you see happening? I mean, what will there be an eventual outcome? What hope do you have for peace in Salvador?
If you want a really detailed answer, I've got... I've just been...
waiting to with this myself. Is El Salvador, is peace possible? This is put up by the Washington office in Latin America. Looking at the various possibilities in light of the negotiations which are happening. I mean, at this point, negotiations mediated by the United Nations, Javier Perez de Cuellar, as the Secretary General, are kind of on again, off and off again. Last week, I hear they broke down again. And actually, there are a lot, at this point, it seems there are a lot of points of convergence between the FMLN, the government. The FMLN is no longer demanding that there be constitutional changes. That was demands met. The basic stumbling block is what's going to happen with the army. The FMLN is demanding that the army be purged of the most corrupt leadership elements, that the security forces be turned into a civilian police force or under civilian control, including like the National Guard, Treasury Police, National Police, and that they the numbers be reduced. Well, there's tremendous resistance to that. Not so much by President Christiani. I think he's favorable to some concessions, but right-wing elements in his party and in the military are very resistant to that. And as long as they get U.S. dollars, they're going to see no reason to give in to FMLN demands.
How have they managed to keep replenishing that army? Where do they get, I know that the soldiers are very young, where do they get them?
They're conscripted off the streets from bus stops, from rural communities, and almost entirely from poor neighborhoods. Like, it's the poor people that are conscripted.
So ostensibly these are people who are Catholic or have been touched by some church, and yet they are the people that are continuing, that are committing the worst of the human rights abuses.
Well, the people in the army, I think the human rights abuses are mostly the responsibility of the officer corps. And there's a lot of evidence that the death squads are really closely linked with the officer corps of the Salvadoran military. And the reality is that most of those people are trained in the U.S. for Bragg and so on. And military officers that run military schools like that can't explain. I mean, they say they do everything in their power to train these people not to commit human rights violations. They don't understand how it happens that between Fort Bragg and El Salvador, they become such animals. I guess there's a lot of permission given to soldiers too to not respect human rights. So there's a lot of corruption throughout the ranks. Part of it is because there's not a judicial system in El Salvador that functions, and everybody recognizes that. And nobody has ever been prosecuted for human rights violations within the army, although there's a lot of documentation, a lot of evidence in certain cases. But there's a lot of... the officers, for instance, are members of a particular tanda, or a class, a military class, and these people stick up for one another and make it very difficult for any one member of a class to be isolated and prosecuted. And that's especially true of the Tandona, the big class of 66, which controls most of the military elite, or is most of the military elite in El Salvador. So they get away with all sorts of abuse, violations, murder.
Hasn't the U.S. said, we know you're committing human rights abuses, you need to stop this, and we'll continue to give you money, and we'll call it aid or relief?
That's all. Yeah, the aid has always been conditional on improvement of human rights violations. And yet, no matter what the record, the aid has never been cut or reduced. And even when six Jesuit priests are murdered, the aid is not cut. And even when there's tremendous evidence that the trial is going nowhere and never will go anywhere, still there's no move to cut military aid. So it's hard for anybody to take
those kinds of conditions or those kinds of threats very seriously.
So it sounds like no matter what happens in El Salvador, with the people in El Salvador, the U.S. government's not going to stop the aid. If something happened in the U.S. among the U.S. people?
I think that's what it would have to take.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, you would have a better idea of that than I, but it seems to me that the U.S. government is, and in league with the Salvadoran government, has a pretty clear idea of how far they can go before the U.S. people will revolt or not accept this. In the situation of Vietnam, the U.S. citizens were no longer prepared to send over their people to be killed in that war. So the U.S. has learned from that not to send over U.S. troops. They've learned to train Salvadorans to kill their own people. And U.S. citizens don't mind that. I mean, not sufficiently. I know with the Lutheran Church, with Presbyterian Church, a lot of solidarity groups, there's a lot of protest. But the U.S. government knows that it's not adequate, or it's not sufficient protest to pressure them into changing policy, at least at this point. And I think it's very dangerous to suggest that, or to dismiss this kind of warfare as if we're not invading, it couldn't be too serious. It's a very carefully strategized program of low-intensity warfare that's very insidious and very destructive. It's killed 75,000 people in El Salvador alone. I would recommend reading Jack Nelson Pallmeyer's book, War Against the Poor. He's done a lot of extensive research, and he has a series of tapes here at Holden, too, from his earlier series this summer, on what low-intensity warfare means and how insidious it is. But it's meant to deceive not only the Salvadoran population, but the U.S., Canadian, European population into thinking that it's not happening. It's a psychological warfare. It involves a lot of deception and disinformation.
The point last night, Brian, was well taken when you said that lack of information and disinformation over the United States, photographs that I've seen of the disappeared, are so, as you said, so inhuman. It's not. It's hard to conceive that a human being would do that to another human being. But those kinds of photographs, one that sticks out in my mind, and I don't even want to describe it because it's so disgusting. I think if any human saw that, could do nothing but react in horror and require a response. But that kind of information is able to be kept out of any kind of newspapers or magazines or whatever that is sort of the popular reading in terms of what U.S. foreign policy is going on.
I found it very instructive a couple of months ago. I've been called on by various departments of the Canadian government to speak and share experiences. And when they took me through their offices, they gave me information which they use as reference, both respect to El Salvador, Guatemala, and a number of other countries, and they use for their information State Department reports out of Washington on the situations. But in giving those to me, they said they also gave me the reports of America's Watch and I think it was America's Watch. What's the other name? Amnesty International. And they were very clear in saying, do not take this Washington report too seriously. Match it with this other. And that was very instructive because the Canadian government is very reluctant to speak out against U.S. policy. But in this case, they didn't want to give me the Washington version without being very clear about, be sure you read the critique of America's Watch and Amnesty International.
I think right now is a pretty key time for people to write their senators, because apparently the House of Representatives did cut Salvador aid in the last session of the House of Representatives, and it will be debated in the Senate this fall, and I think you said it too, didn't you?
Yes, I spoke at the end of June in New York with, and I can't remember her name, Laura, I think.
but she's with a Lutheran and also ecumenical office in Washington, lobbying the government on Central American matters. And she's done that for years, and she's very well in tune, in touch with the different senators, congresspeople on these issues, and she had a very optimistic sense about what was happening in the minds and in the decision making of the people in Washington.
We got a call from an international, and I can't remember the name of that, but they were specifically saying they will be pushing hard this fall to have everyone contact those senators to express their wish that aid, American aid to El Salvador, would cut because they felt this was the important vote this fall. So if you want to do one thing that's worthwhile, it's to write to senators and say we should not be sending $1.5 million a day to El Salvador that is that purchases these guns and bullets that do the things.
Brian, from your perspective, if aid were totally cut off, what would be the result that you would see could happen down there?
Well, I think it's fairly widely recognized that the government and its military there would collapse fairly readily. And that's been acknowledged by previous ambassadors, too, who have become disillusioned and have either been forced out or left. Is it White? Robert White is ambassador. I think he has said that the government will last 2 weeks if U.S. aid was discontinued. What the Salvadorans would say would be that military, any form of military, whether it's direct military or counterinsurgency economic aid, be cut. But that the U.S. has really the responsibility of maintaining humanitarian aid and rebuilding the structure of the society, which has been destroyed through so much war and exploitation. So not an absolute cut, but a rechanneling in terms of rebuilding and bringing life back to El Salvador.